Exciting news from Wall Street. Our wealth markets are booming. Everything from the Dow Jones average to gold prices are rocketing to new records, showering us with wealth from above. Oh, wait, maybe you're one of the big majority of workaday Americans who don't own stocks or gold, so maybe you're not celebrating Wall Street's big boom. But just chill, because conventional corporate wisdom assures us that the wealthy will invest their good fortunes in enterprises that eventually will produce trickle-down gains for everyone. Excuse my rudeness, but let's take a peek at how those who are reaping today's big buck bonanza are actually investing that wealth. Look at Wall Streeters themselves. The big banks have been making money like bankers, with their stock prices zooming up by 28% just since January. So how are these moneyed elites spending this windfall? Not by making job-creating investments, but by simply giving the money to their big shareholders, including their own top executives, nearly all of whom are already among the richest people on Earth. The main way they do this is through a sleight of hand called a stock buyback. The honchos simply cash out the bulk of that 28% increase in the value of the bank's stock price, using that money to repurchase more of their bank's own stock from lesser shareholders. Hocus pocus, this manipulation artificially pumps up the value of the stock these insider shareholders already own, making each of them even richer than rich, although they've done absolutely nothing to earn this increased wealth. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's not a small scam. J.P. Morgan Chase is now sinking $30 billion into buying its own stock. Wells Fargo is shifting $18 billion into the scheme, and Bank of America is throwing $25 billion into its buyback. Wall Street bankers are the biggest robbers in America. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
One of the things that I've tried to impress upon my oldest daughter especially, and my all three of my kids, is that you got to start saving for retirement early. Male, female, doesn't matter. You got to start doing that. In fact, we started a Roth IRA for my daughter when she was 15. She got her first job. We said, we're going to start up with this Roth IRA. We're going to take half of your earnings, going to throw it in there. And in 50, 60, 70 years, that, you know, couple thousand dollars we're going to put aside is going to be real money. That whole compound interest thing. Sadly, you think about this, and I go back to when I was a kid. I wish someone would have done that for me, because I didn't start really saving for retirement until my 30s. And thanks to my union, they started a little bit sooner. Retirement security is one of those things never too early to talk about, but especially for women, because what we're finding out is that, women are falling way behind, or have fallen way behind men. And I look at my wife, who stayed home to raise our children. I worry what happens when I go, and here to share some thoughts on how can we shore up retirement security for women from this day going forward. I've asked Maria Fries to come talk with us. She's a senior policy advisor with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Their website, ncpss.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Maria, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is a subject that is near and dear to my heart, so I'm more than happy to come and talk about it anytime.
So how bad is it? How bad are women screwed in the retirement world?
Well, many people are aware of the gender gap in pay, that women these days are earning about 82 cents for every dollar earned by a man. But most people don't realize that there's also a gender gap in retirement. So if you have a man and a woman that are hitting 60, they've been working 40 years doing comparable jobs, the man decides, oh, I have enough money, I can retire. The woman has to work another 9 years, almost a decade, well past Social Security's retirement age, before she will have accumulated as much as the man did in terms of lifetime earnings. That's a big gap. Right. And it really does affect women's ability to retire.
Now, why is that? Is that childbearing years? Is that, is that gender inequality? What's the cause of that?
Well, the pay gap is gender inequality. There are other reasons on top of the pay gap that affect retirement gap. The pay gap is purely calculated on comparable job pay. And I think the large portion of the reason for that is the fact that most employers are men. And so they don't value the jobs that are primarily done by women, even in the same businesses. For example, you work in a factory. If you're the office manager, you're just as important to that business being able to function as you are if you're the shop foreman. Shop foreman's usually a man. Office manager is usually a woman. Foreman's almost inevitably going to get paid more than the woman that's doing the office work. And if the office falls apart, it's just as damaging to the company as it is if the foreman can't get a product out. So when you have that kind of inequity built through the system, it just makes it harder and harder for women to get to retirement age and have enough accumulated.
You know, when you talk about those things, I'm a big fan of transparency. As a union guy, I believe union contracts can solve a lot of these problems simply by making it transparent, writing it down on paper and justifying why it's on paper. So for me, that's the direction that I would go. Is there a way that you see outside of that, that we would go to change that situation? Or is it possible
to
change?
We'd love to get more women in managerial positions and in ownership positions. As you know, if you have a little bit of history, Lilly Ledbetter was a woman who went all the way to the Supreme Court to be able to get some of that transparency that you're talking about.
Yep.
Because in most workplaces, you're not allowed to talk about how much you're earning. And that's part of the reason that women don't know that they're being undervalued. If you can't talk with your coworkers that are doing the same jobs or comparable jobs and find out what they're getting paid, you may go through an entire working career and not know that you have been undervalued. And so the legislation that passed that that strips away that protection was a good thing, but you still need to do more. And the Paycheck Fairness Act, which passed the House earlier this year, would have been a good next step. But of course, couldn't overcome the filibuster in the Senate, so right. It couldn't go anywhere.
Now, you brought up the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which I always get into trouble with my female listeners who get angry when I say that shouldn't have ever happened. We shouldn't have wasted the political capital on passing that piece of legislation. What we should have done is we should have passed comprehensive labor law reform so that Lilly Ledbetter didn't get cheated for those 40 years. We shouldn't have changed the law to go, oh, once she finds out, she can go and sue. We should have changed it to go, hey, let's make sure Lilly never gets cheated.
I can't disagree with you on that, although as an organization, we're focused on Social Security and Medicare, and my expertise is not in labor law, but I certainly wouldn't argue with you about that point, because there are ways of creating solutions through the ability of people to negotiate for their contracts and negotiate power, get some power in the balance. So that they can actually do a better job.
And transparency. Work. Look, at the end of the day, if Lilly Ledbetter was a union member, if she had the ability to join and form a union, she would know what her coworkers were making. She would know what she's making. And right in the book, she'd find it out. And there wouldn't be 40 years of being cheated. But you did bring up Social Security because obviously that is your area of expertise. Is this a way that we could maybe, you know, change that balance and help women catch up a little bit by maybe adding a little bit to Social Security to kind of bump that up? Because Social Security is or was supposed to be an anti-poverty program. We want to make sure women stay out of poverty. Is this a way that maybe you can level that playing field a little?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's our focus. You can try to solve the problem a lot of different ways, one of which we have been talking about now, which is try to work on some of the pay disparities. Women also tend to end up in service jobs, which don't usually have any kind of pension or even access to a 401k plan necessarily. Women are more likely to be working part-time. And as you know, part-time workers have very limited access to retirement plans at work. Women are also more likely to take time out for caregiving. That's another problem. And so you have all these workplace issues that can get very controversial and very difficult to try to resolve. So we focus on as much as we can on the retirement end. And one of the ways of fixing that problem on the retirement end is expanding Social Security. Social Security already does some of that because the benefit is progressive, which means that you get more bang for your buck if you are a lower lifetime earner than you do if you're a high income. You're still going to get a bigger Social Security check if you earned more over a lifetime. But the way the formula works, you get more of a value for your dollar if you are lower lifetime earner. And that's the only program that works that way. That being said, we haven't had major Social Security reform since the mid-1980s, and the workplace has changed since then. So we firmly believe that we should be doing expansions of Social Security. We should be doing programs, legislation to restore the value of a lot of those benefits. A number of proposals are out there, and some of them are, they're all gender neutral, but some tend to help women more than others. For example, fixing the cost of living adjustment. Social Security is the only retirement program we have with an automatic cost of living adjustment, but it's pegged on a an inflation indicator that doesn't correspond with the kinds of things that older people buy. Older people tend to spend more of their money on healthcare, for right. example, and healthcare expenses grow faster usually than the rest of the economy. And so we're constantly falling further and further behind. Women who live longer than men get impacted by that more because the longer you live, the longer your inflation is undercalculated, the further and further behind you fall over time. So there are proposals to readjust how the COLAs are calculated. That would help everybody, but especially would help women because we live longer. There are provisions out there to try to help surviving spouses because, as we talked about earlier, women tend to outlive their husbands. We tend to be the surviving spouses. And these proposals would end up boosting benefits for the survivors. Just because there's only one of us doesn't mean that our expenses get cut in half. You still have to pay for housing. You still have to pay for electric. You still have to pay for your health care. There are a lot of expenses that we have that aren't necessarily cut in half when we lose a spouse, and yet our Social Security benefits are cut in half. And so there are proposals out there to try to improve that. There are proposals to boost everybody's benefits, so nobody is below the poverty line in retirement, which is another positive impact. Right. So there are bills out there to try to make those changes.
But how do you do that? And look, I'm all in favor in increasing benefits and having a better leveling system. But how do you do that in a system that we're told is already losing money, that, you know, in a couple of years, we're going to potentially see some radical changes. We haven't done anything to scrap the cap or increase that top number very much. So we're concerned there isn't enough money going in. At the same time, where we're almost hitting the point of where, you know, like 40-45% of working people are now in these gig jobs that aren't contributing to Social Security, setting up an even bigger retirement problem down the road. How do we deal with that?
Well, the gig workers are supposed to be contributing to Social Security. They are self-employed. And in fact, gig workers are supposed to be contributing both the employee and the employer share of the Social Security FICA tax. Now,
keyword,
it's a lot hard. Yeah, it's supposed to. Yes, it's a lot harder to monitor that, obviously, than it is if you're getting a form from your employer who has to also report it to IRS. So it's a bigger challenge. But you're absolutely right. It's going to take some increased revenue into the system because under current projections, no matter how exact the numbers are, at some point in the next decade or two, you're not going to have enough income coming in through the FICA tax as it's structured right now to be able to pay full benefits. There's still going to be money coming in, so you're still going to be able to pay benefits, but you won't be able to pay 100% of benefits. So one way or the other, we have to figure out a way to get more revenue into the system.
Right.
But you do it as part of a package that includes the benefit improvements, that includes the extension of solvency, and you figure out what the program should look like, and then you figure out how you're going to be able to pay for it. And we need to do both.
Yeah, because when my 19-year-old daughter, she's 19 now, and we sat down when she was 15 to fill out her Roth IRA forms and get her started in this, you know, she said at 15 that she believed that she was never going to see a Social Security check. They're starting that kind of rhetoric early. And I don't know if that's, you know, give the Social Security haters credit for being able to reach that far down, or if we just haven't done a good enough job to say, no, it's not going to go bankrupt. There's just going to be some changes, but we can alleviate that by making smart choices. But my daughter at a very young age said, no, that's not going to be there for me, which is why she was so into going, hey, how do I save for retirement now at 15 years old?
Well, that's absolutely right. And unfortunately for us, the other side has significantly more resources available to plant the misinformation than we do to try to correct it. And so it's been an ongoing problem of people scaremongering, particularly the young, that the program's not going to be there for them, and therefore undermining the support that the program has among Americans so that they can get rid of it and move everything over to Wall Street. So it's been an ongoing problem. On the side for your daughter, you have to remember Social Security was never intended to be the sole source of people's retirement. There was always an expectation that you would have other income coming in retirement.
The three-legged stool.
A pension, for example, a traditional pension. Remember the old three-legged stool? Well, it was going to be Social Security benefits, a traditional pension, and then whatever private savings you managed to have either in your account, bank account, in your home value, and whatever else you've managed to save. Well, traditional pensions, as you know, as the union representation has gotten smaller, traditional pensions are harder and harder to find, and they're certainly not available in a non-unionized work environment. So that's the only thing that's left there. And people are saving less and less, especially younger ones. I don't know whether your daughter has gotten through college yet, but these college kids that are coming through with these massive debts coming out of college that they're going to have to pay back, not only are they not saving for their retirement, they're not able to buy housing. They are falling further behind than my generation was, which is, you never want that for your children and your grandchildren to be worse off financially than you were when you were growing up. You want things to be better for them.
No, and you're
Social Security is the only thing that's left that we haven't undermined. And here you've got these Wall Street guys that are basically trying to do that too.
No, I said this the other day about the three-legged stool. I go, it used to be, for my grandparents, it was a solid wooden, good solid three-legged stool. They've whittled those three legs down to one, basically a stick that they now want to beat us with because they want to take Social Security away. Because the defined benefit pension is a thing of the past. Like you said, there are a handful of union members who still have them, but good luck finding it. It's almost like a holy grail for people nowadays. And personal savings, because wages have been stagnant for 45 plus years. That's getting harder to do. And Social Security's got some problems at a time when we need it most. So last line of questioning I've got for you, how do we shore this up? What's the marching order? What are we telling people we want to do? How do we get to the place that, you know, as we've been saying, we want some equity. We want women to have retirement security, but we want a system that's going to be solvent and shore up the bottom. How do we get there?
Well, we've been working with a number of members of Congress that are planning to reintroduce comprehensive reform bills. Congressman John Larson of Connecticut, for example, is the chairman of the House Ways and Means Social Security Subcommittee, and he had a comprehensive expansion and reform bill in the previous Congress. He's working on a new one this year that also reflects President Biden's priorities, because the president also had some proposals on Social Security during the campaign trail. So once those bills get introduced, what we're hoping is that the public will actually start pushing their members of Congress to support them. And in Pennsylvania, for example, you have some members of Congress, particularly on the Senate side, that are less likely to be willing to support something like that. And so we would urge people in states, particularly with Republican or conservative Democratic members, to push their members of Congress to try to support these pieces of legislation. And also make a little plug for us, join organizations like ours. What we do is lobby for Social Security and Medicare. We combine the voting power of all of our members and supporters, and we go up to the Hill and we tell members, you have X number of our members and supporters in your state or district, and they all support this bill, and they support Social Security, and they want to see it strengthened and expanded. They don't want to see benefits cut. So that's a large part of what we do. The more members and supporters we can get, the more people that would lobby their members on this issue, the better chance we have of actually moving it forward. And our website has wealth of information, all kinds of details on proposals as they come out and everything else. The website is our initials, National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, NCPSSM.org. We'd love to have as many additional members as we can, because there's strength in numbers, and you have to not only have numbers, but you have to be the squeaky wheel. You've got to be the people in there clamoring for this program. And I think part of what's happened is people have gotten a little complacent. They either think it's not going to be there for them, or on the other hand, they think it'll always be there and we don't need to fight for it. And neither one of those situations.
And then there's the other one. I got mine. I don't care about anybody else. That's sad. But Maria,
we have to fight for it.
Yep, I'm there with you. I appreciate you taking some time for us. Hope folks will check out the website there at the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. We'll get links out on how you can do that. But Maria Fries, I appreciate you taking time for me.
Anytime. Happy to do it.
Good stuff. Thanks so much. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Are you planning for retirement? Are you talking to your kids about retirement? I'd love to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day some of the worst violence of the Great Railroad Strike erupted in Pittsburgh. The strike started days earlier. It's contested as to whether it began in Martinsburg, West Virginia, or Baltimore, Maryland. The strike spread rapidly along the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad to New York State, Pennsylvania, and throughout the Midwest. At its height, the Great Railroad Strike involved well over 100,000 workers. The strike began on the Pennsylvania Railroad on the 19th. Management repeatedly tried to move trains through the yards and was confronted by angry strikers. Pennsylvania guardsmen were called out. The strikers presented the railroad with their demands. They wanted an end to double-engine trains that required fewer workers, wages reinstated, reinstatement for their fired co-workers, and an end to pay grades. Local militia sided with the strikers and refused to show for duty. When thousands of strikers gathered at the depot, the Pennsylvania National Guard moved unsuccessfully to disperse them. Then they fired on the strikers, killing 20 and wounding 29. The strikers were infuriated by the deadly aggression and drove guardsmen into a nearby railroad roundhouse. Word spread quickly throughout the city of the massacre, launching a virtual general strike. Workers began seizing arms wherever they could find them. They set fires to dozens of railroad buildings, burned down the Union Depot, destroyed over 100 locomotives, and more than 1,000 freight and passenger cars. The next day, guardsmen shot their way out of the roundhouse, killing 20 more as they were chased from the city. A total of 3,000 federal troops would be necessary to quell strikers' fury by month's end. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Retirement security is really one of those things that I worry about for my kids especially. Because, you know, there's a real possibility politically that the Republicans, who have been hell-bent on privatizing Social Security, could get their way. And can you imagine? I mean, stop and think of, had George Bush had his way and they went and they privatized, you know, huge swaths of Social Security right before the 2008 collapse. Can you imagine how many people would be, you know, basically destitute? Then you fast forward it to the next calamity here during the Trump years. Can you imagine how much, you know, people would have lost? Now, it's bounced back a lot faster from last year than it did 2008, 2009, 2010. But can you imagine how many people would have been harmed by that? And then look, it doesn't jump right back to where it was. There's a period of where you're losing interest potential. And then shame on the people who need to take it out during the trough, during the downturn. And it's something I've been trying to, you know, tell my kids, because I wish someone would have grabbed me aside and said, no, you need to put a little bit of something aside and forget about it. I didn't get smart until I was about 30. But, you know, And it's, you know, because, you know, you started thinking down the road. But, you know, hopefully my kids will be a lot smarter than I am. And that's the whole thing we want. We just want our kids to be smarter than we are. We want them to have better opportunities and better lives than we were able to do. That really is the American dream kind of thing, that we want to do as well as we can, but we want our kids to always do better. We want better opportunities for them, better education, better health care, a better future. Or at least I think that. I could be wrong. Interesting story by The Guardian. And again, it's amazing to me that The Guardian, a newspaper in the UK, is where the reporting on workplace safety in the US has to go to be reported. Evidently, there's a new report out by the IZEA, Institute of Labor Economics, that actually looked at the data in California of people who got hurt on the job between 2001 and 2018. They looked at some 11.6 million claims, 11.6 million claims. And what they did is they went and they tried to, you know, with weather data, they found what the weather temperature was, you know, during the time of these injuries, because they're all dated. So you can put them into date form and find, you know, on you know, when it was 60 degrees out, how many people got hurt? When it was 70 degrees out, how many people got hurt? When it was 80, 90. And what they came up with is that injuries went up when the temperature was between 80 and 85 degrees, 3.5 times more than if it were on a 60 degree day. And when it got to be 90 and 95, the risk of someone being injured went up 7% over that of a, you know, a 60 degree day. And as they pointed out, if you know, on a 95 degree day, you get a little dizzy and you fall off a ladder, that's not a heat related injury. That's, you just fell off a ladder, and that's how it's reported. Now, interesting that California has a law that employers are supposed to, they have this heat illness prevention standard, which employers are supposed to ensure that outdoor workers have access to cool water, shade, an opportunity to get hydrated and to keep their body temperature down. But and look, they're claiming that this legislation, this law, has reduced the heat related injuries by a third. But according to this data, California only reported 60 heat related injuries per year over the last several years. Only 60 people had heat related. So that's like heat stroke, you know, and that's something that would be a diagnosis. Well, he definitely fell over of dehydration because of the heat, you know, only 60 of those. So that's telling me a couple of things. Out of 11.6 million claims, you're only getting 60 per year. That's telling me employers are doing some pretty interesting, you know, shenanigans with the categorization, and that, you know, the medical profession probably a little in on it too. What they also found out is the poorer you are, the more likely you're going to get injured during a high heat time of the year. And I would argue that without the research, that the lower your income, the more likely you're going to be injured on the job as well, because you're generally doing more manual labor, more risky kind of labor for employers who are, well, a little shadier. So that not so much to me is a surprise to me. But, you know, the numbers going up, kind of an interesting thing and something that we should be looking at. And again, the reason I bring this up is I would argue that you could mitigate some of that by ensuring that people have the voice in the workplace to say, you know what, I need a little break. I need to go in where it's cool a little bit, take a drink, and not be harassed by an employer to, you know, crack the whip, so to speak. Kind of like some of the horror stories we hear from Amazon. Because some of the horror stories I've heard is, you know, the factories or the warehouses are unbearably hot in some of them. And the pace of the work is outrageous. In fact, I was just reading a story of a woman who worked at Amazon who had a miscarriage because they wouldn't give her, you know, lighter duty work to do. In fact, you know, I would argue they probably gave her heavier work to do to make her to head out the door, because that's how cruel some people are. Anyway, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Does that make sense? The hotter it gets, the more likely it is people are to be injured. Makes perfect sense to me. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
In one of the world's wealthiest nations, advanced infrastructure was no match for Mother Nature.
Catastrophic floods in Germany show nowhere is safe from our worsening climate emergency. Parts of Amazon rainforest now emit more CO2 than it absorbs. Plus,
the NASA study predicts flooding will sometimes occur in clusters lasting a month or longer in the 2030s.
High tide flooding hit a record in the U.S. last year. NASA warns it's going to get much, much worse.
All of that moon wobbling and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
California is in the grip of a drought, and that's causing Sacramento's drinking water to taste like dirt. But one city official assured residents it might not taste great, but it's still safe to drink. And was immediately sued for copyright infringement by Michelob Ultra.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, boy howdy, you are right. Nowhere is safe. What an horrific sight we all saw in Germany last week.
Yes, it was. As we go to air, nearly 200 are confirmed dead in catastrophic flooding in Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands as rescuers search for hundreds that are still listed as missing. Days of torrential rain triggered wildly destructive flash floods that swept away buildings, destroyed communications and transportation, and displaced thousands. German officials say the historic floods far exceeded the conditions that their flood control systems were designed for, and exposed flaws and gaps in the country's emergency alert systems. The disaster hit just days after the European Union announced its ambitious roadmap to cut carbon emissions that cause dangerous man-made climate change, and the floods have pushed climate action to the front of national elections to replace retiring Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Good.
The influence of man-made climate change in this specific event will take time to determine, but the floods are just the latest in a wave of extreme weather disasters around the world, including record heat and forest fires in Russian Siberia, and Canada and the U.S. West grappling with historic drought and record-smashing high temperatures that cooked fruit on trees. In the U.S., fire crews are battling more than 70 major fires. Oregon's Bootleg Fire, the largest in the U.S. so far this year, has burned more than 530 square miles and is so hot that it is disrupting the atmosphere. In California, utility giant Pacific Gas and Electric announced that its aging equipment may have sparked the Dixie Fire.
May? Are those people still in business?
Experts say the wave of extreme disasters shows that even the world's richest nations are not prepared for cascading consequences of climate change, underscoring the need for governments to move quickly on adaptation projects to build infrastructure resilience against intensifying extreme weather disasters, even as they also cut greenhouse gas emissions. Here's Penn State University climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann in an interview with Democracy Now!
The fact that we're in both of these countries right now are witnessing the devastating impacts of climate change really drove home the point that we have to act now. Dangerous climate change is here. Catastrophic climate change is here. And at this point, it's a matter of how bad we're willing to let it get.
Oh, I fear we are willing to let it get much, much worse.
Well, those consequences are arriving earlier than predicted. New research published in the journal Nature shows that parts of the Amazon rainforest in South America now emit more carbon dioxide than they absorb, primarily caused by deforestation, fires, and global warming.
Let me repeat that. They now emit more carbon than they absorb. The Amazon used to be our carbon sink. It would keep us safe. It would suck up all the carbon. Now it's putting off more than it is taking in.
NOAA announced that sunny day flooding, or routine flooding at high tide, hit a record along U.S. coasts over the last year due to rising sea levels. And NASA, in a new first-of-its-kind study, warned that a natural shift in the moon's orbit around the Earth, combined with rising sea levels, will cause high tide flooding to jump 5 to 10-fold in the mid-2030s, hitting some areas near daily.
Now, of course, that would happen whether there was climate change on Earth or not. This is just making it all much worse, correct?
Yes. But there is some good news.
Good.
The nation of Greenland has suspended all oil exploration because of climate change, with its environmental minister explaining, quote, "The future does not lie in oil. The future belongs to renewable energy, and in that respect, we have much more to gain."
Nice.
Finally, in that Democracy Now! Interview, Dr. Mann says there is hope in taking action.
There is still time. Don't let the doomers convince you it's too late to do anything about climate change. That leads us down the same path of inaction as outright denial. And the forces of inaction would love nothing more than for environmental progressives to remain on the sidelines because they're convinced it's too late to do anything. It isn't too late, but we have to act, and we have to act now.
Oh, it's too late. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I know everyone loved Dr. Anthony Fauci going after Rand Paul, basically telling him, literally telling him, you don't know what you're talking about. Basically smacking him down, which I thought was great. And I'm going, yeah, it's great. Nice job. Congratulations. You're probably going to regret it. because today Rand Paul came out and said he's going to send a letter to the DOJ to have him investigated and potentially arrested. Tried, convicted. He's gonna try and get him to go after him. Now, will it happen? I don't know. I'm not quite sure that the Biden DOJ will go that route, but you know, it kind of makes you wonder. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the doctor, the rising virus, and much more. I've asked our good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, to share some thoughts and give some insight on these top stories. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
So I'm sure you saw Fauci, you know, going off on him, which I thought was great. About damn time.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Is he going to regret it?
I don't think he's going to regret it. I think Dr. Fauci has to be a bit careful just on a couple of things. And I was a Fauci fan. I'm just seeing some things he's saying, and I'm thinking, okay, just be a little bit careful in the sense of not what Rand Paul's talking about. When he said, if you question science, you question me, I'm the face of it. He's making himself the face of this issue.
Yeah.
I think that's a problem for him. If it continues, then you know how that runs. You become the face of something, somebody tries to rip your face off.
Yep.
So that's always a problem. And then the second thing is the numbers. You know, he said, well, I really didn't want to say that we need more than 70% on the herd immunity. So there's a few things there, like you can with science. I understand that. A few things there he, you know, might have some problems with that, you know, people can kind of bash him on that. Then it becomes science versus Dr. Fauci, the vaccinations versus Dr. Fauci, and I just don't want to see it go that direction. I think he's got a lot to offer. As far as Rand Paul, criminal investigation for lying to, I'm sorry, I'm laughing, but want me to go back through the history of people who have lied to Congress, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing happens if they do lie to Congress. So this is just Rand Paul's way of then saying, well, you see, the Biden administration really doesn't want to know, about the gain of function research and China, and they love China and blah, blah, blah. So I don't think this goes anywhere.
Yeah, it makes for good. As I said at the beginning of the show, it's kind of like the WWGOP. This is all, waiting for Mean Gene to come out and, you know, all of the characters to do their spiel. This is kind of that.
Right. So I don't think in the long run, again, this does anything. I do think Dr. Fauci has to be careful that he doesn't, again, become the face of, you know, anything that goes wrong. It was the Fauci syndrome that did it. So I just think he has to be careful because he has good things to offer.
No, he does. But, you know, the Republicans are kind of pushing him into this. I mean, I'm sure you've seen down in Florida how, you know, DeSantis' campaign is selling all of the, you know, don't Fauci Florida, you know, propaganda, the T-shirts and the beer koozies and all that stuff.
Oh, yes. And I mean, look, I think Fauci should hit back. In fact, you know, the whole Democrat messaging at certain times, what they say on the committees, I'm just sitting there as a former member thinking about things I've heard for 11 years while I was there. I mean, there's some things I think the Democrats can come back at Republican members and hit them pretty good instead of just saying, oh, be quiet, you're obnoxious. I think there's some real ways to come back and cut at them, you know, for actions they've done, things they've done. So, yes, I think you've got to, you know, it's not a spectator sport. So what he did was not wrong in fighting back.
Now, what's interesting is I don't know if you're seeing it, but I'm starting to see some Republican voices, some you know, conservative voices who were anti-vax, who were, yeah, don't get the vaccine, it's all a hoax, who are now coming around to saying, no, you know, you should go do that now because the numbers are rising again. And it happens to be, well, you know, mostly in areas that listen to them.
Correct. The numbers are rising. You have a Republican member who, you know, has the, I think he's got the variant. And of course, on a bipartisan basis, three of the Texas legislators, you know, came to the Capitol, and I guess, you know, they've got something. It's there. You know, this virus doesn't pick and choose who it goes to. You know, it's transmitted. So, I like a comment you made on your show the other day, which I think is correct. There's not going to be a, you know, unless something way out happens, a massive shutdown, but there's going to have to be steps to be taken. I think the worst thing that happened, Rick, was the CDC saying, oh, if you had the vaccination, you don't have to wear your mask, but we're going to have the honor system. If you haven't had it, you got to wear your mask. I think right there was a problem.
No, because, I've got it. Yeah, you've got all these people who are, you know, and because you were never getting the passport. And look, I wouldn't even stand for that.
I will because I want to travel.
Yeah, look, I'm not a papers please person. It's one of those things that, you know, it's kind of screwy. Because look, I'm traveling in October. Mm-hmm. You know, I got a speaking gig coming up in October, and we're going to Alaska. I desperately want to go. I love Alaska.
Right.
But if things keep getting worse, you know what happens? If we start shutting things down again randomly. In certain spots, you know, maybe, but I don't see widespread shutdowns happening again. I think we have to we're going to be forced to power through this. And I'm looking at some of the numbers from Florida, where they're saying it's just crazy. The one ICU, I guess, just a couple of weeks ago had like 16 people in it. They now have 134. They're basically slammed. The daily numbers have gone up from, you know, the beginning of the month like 13,000 up to 37,000. We're now seeing some jumping.
I think it's going to be all over the board. Like I said, I don't mind getting this passport to travel, you know, and I went with my daughter and her family, and we had to wear masks on the plane, and you don't have to wear masks in Home Depot. I mean, so there's, you know, all different ways that they're looking at this. So I don't mind some of that, but there's not going to be, I mean, I agree, there's not going to be a one cure all in it of, you know, just a general shutdown unless it gets, you know, extremely, extremely bad. But there's a bottom line here. The numbers have, the vaccination numbers have to go up. They have to go up. And that will be of a great help. I think most people agree on that.
Do you think the fact that Hannity is now coming out saying that he thinks people should get vaccinated, you got Mitch McConnell going, oh, gee, I don't know why we're not vaccinating people. You think that's going to matter any to the Republican base?
I mean, Mitch McConnell had polio. And so, you know, he's someone that should say, you know, what he's saying. And then with Hannity, I mean, I hope it helps. But then, you know, I've talked to some people who just believe that in 5 years, you know, we who have been vaccinated are going to grow a third ear. You know, I mean, there's just some of that out there. But I think the more people talk about it, the more it helps. And also, you know, I think neighbor to neighbor talking about it. You know, I've tried to share with people in my family and friends that don't want to get vaccinated, of, you know, why I did and, you know, what it was like. And my father's 98 and, you know, he got it and he's alive. So, you know, maybe hopefully that'll help a little bit too, people to people communication.
Now, let's get to the big story of the day. Nancy Pelosi, I'm still in the mindset that this was probably not the best idea. I understand why she did it. But, you know, but rejecting, Jim Jordan and Representative Banks, I don't know that was a great idea.
Yeah, look, I always tell people, you know, there's certain people, you know, I pontificate about, like John Bolton, my favorite punching bag. And people ask me about being in Congress. I got along with Nancy Pelosi when she was the minority leader. I got along with her fine. I just wanted to state that out front. You know, we worked with her office as we did all the offices, but intricately because she was the leader, things like that. So having said that, this is the congressional speech. I like the distinguished lady from California, but then you throw the butt in there. I think this is one of the worst moves I've ever seen her do.
Really?
Ever. Yes. Ever.
See, I fear you've created another side circus that is going to give the Republicans the ability to go on their conservative media, which is dominant in this country, and basically just create their own narrative and give them a reason to ignore what's going on in the committee. But you know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a horrible move. I was in shock. I read into something. I think I'm going to be right in what I say tonight. He didn't say it, but I think I know where he's going with it. And I'm talking about McCarthy, you know, the minority leader. I must say it was probably one of the better speeches I've ever heard him give, in a sense of, you know, how he delivered it, et cetera. It was on CNN. He talked about, you know, I'm not going to go over the whole thing, but Banks is a veteran of Afghanistan. He's been excluded from the committee. You know, he fought for his country. You know, Jordan's been on a select committee. And he knew this would happen. She'd play politics with it. And here's what he referred to, very interesting. He said Chuck Schumer didn't pick who went on the committees. They had two of them in the Senate. And then he talks about, you know, Pelosi sort of being a dictator. And he makes a point, this has never happened. The historian said it's never happened. And he said, so you've got one party that wants to pick everybody. So having said all that, though, here's something he said and what you just were alluding to is going to happen, I think. When he said they're going to create their own inquiry, all right, and this is going to be the sideshow, but here's what he said. He said that they're going to get down to the bottom of why the Capitol was so ill-prepared that day and what you can do to make sure it never happened again. And I'm going to read into that. They're going to go internally because you have the Speaker, the Chair of House Administration, Sergeant of Arms, Chief of Police of the Capitol in the Capitol rank and file. They're going to start to make this an issue that the Speaker and the head of the committees that oversee the security of the Capitol didn't do their job, didn't listen. Maybe the Chief of Police went to one of them. I don't know. They're going to make that the sideshow.
Yep.
I can read between the lines of what McCarthy, the minority leader, said today.
No, I guarantee that's going to be the route because Jim Jordan said basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. And you know they're delivering the signs. We know what's coming, and I would have preferred them to be forced into at least being into that committee and not being able to have their own sideshow. That's the part that's worrying me the most because they have the bigger megaphone.
They do, and you know there's the other thing. Okay, put Jordan on the committee. And, you know, let him be on the committee. You know, people are on the committee, and then McCarthy said this, that he doesn't like that Pelosi put on, but he's not going to tell her, you know, what she can do. She runs, you know, her end of the party. But, okay, Jordan comes on the committee. There's 100 ways to attack Jim Jordan besides saying be quiet, okay?
Yeah.
There's 100 ways, and they could do some of that. Or who are you to talk about doctors? Who are you to talk about this? I mean, It can get down and dirty, and it can get aggressive, and it's, you know, it's a non-spectator sport, as I said earlier. But now it's not going to happen as just the committee to go back and forth and focus on this and banter back and forth. Now there's going to be a separate sideshow that the media will pay attention to.
Oh, absolutely. You know, that whole both-sidism kind of thing And look, as I've said, you know, the Republicans know they've got a bigger microphone. So for me, the reason I would have wanted Jim Jordan on there is because I think at some point you got to call him as a witness. Same thing as with McCarthy. I think you have to call them and put them under Correct. Oath and find out what they know and what they did and all of that stuff.
Like I said, 100 points you can make on him.
Yep.
But I was amazed. I don't know who advised. This is not, by the way, this is not in the speaker's character. I know her. I serve with her. It's not in her character to just say, you know, I'm going to do this. Usually she's one who, you know, institutionally, okay, you know, you do what you do and we'll do what we do on our side. So I don't know. Somebody made a suggestion and it must have kind of looked good at the time. So we'll see what happens. It'll be a battle.
See, for me, I would have left Jordan on there simply because I would want Jordan and Cheney going at each other.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you and I could sit down and think of a, you know, we could write questions for this committee members. You know, we could write questions for them that would be fantastic. And there's going to be a natural animosity anyway from Cheney, you know, to Jordan. So
because wasn't the story that he had reached his hand out to help her, and you know, she basically said, "You effing did this."
Yes, that's what's out there.
Yeah, and I want that testimony.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So. Well,
Tuesday, right?
Right. I just don't think it was a good move.
This starts Tuesday, right?
I think it's Tuesday. Yes.
I can't wait for Tuesday. Mm-hmm. We'll see what kind of coverage it gets, and you know, I'm hoping somebody will be tracking, you know, how many stories from each thing ends up on the mainstream news.
Right.
Going to be interesting to see how it plays out. But Bob, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney. No, seriously, I there's part of me that goes, you know, I understand, you know, you don't want it to turn into a circus. You don't want, you know, Jim Jordan tanking your whole thing. But man, the fact that you'd have Liz Cheney, two Republicans going at each other, and you can just sit back and go. And let the fireworks happen while you just separate yourself from it. I don't know what went into going, yeah, we're going to throw him off. And again, I'd love to have him seen him been called. So I guess this could have been, you know, this is a favor that Nancy played for the Republicans, because now they're going to have their own little kangaroo court. Love to hear your thoughts. Was she right? Did she do the right thing? You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1878. That was the day that a new song was introduced to the U.S. labor movement. Reverend Jesse H. Jones set the lyrics of a poem that had been written by I.G. Blanchard more than a decade earlier. The song was called The 8-Hour Day. The fight for 8 hours had become one of the central causes of labor. In 1850, the average work week was 70 hours. This meant that workers had little time for anything else beside their daily toil. After the Civil War, calls for the 8-hour day gained momentum. It became a movement that united workers from different workplaces and backgrounds. 8-hour leagues were formed in cities across the nation. They hosted talks and rallies to spread the word about the need to shorten the work week. At rallies, protesters waved 8-hour banners. They also sang the song that became their anthem. The first verse boldly began, "We mean to make things over. We are tired of toil for naught, with but bare enough to live upon, and never an hour for thought. We want to feel the sunshine. We want to smell the flowers. We are sure that God has willed it, and we mean to have 8 hours. We're summoning our forces from the shipyard, shop, and mill. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will." The 8-Hour Day song continues to be reimagined today, including this version by Rhythm Fast. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a guy from Tampa. Yes, another Florida man. A lot of people from Florida caught up in this January 6th insurrection. But this guy pled guilty yesterday to joining the stack formation. This was that kind of wedge thing that they were pushing through the crowd with these group of oath keepers to breach the Capitol on the 6th. Evidently, he's been cooperating with prosecutors. And he's pled guilty to one count of conspiracy and one count of obstructing an official proceeding. And what's important about that is he's saying, look, that was the intent. The intent all along was to do what what even Trump himself said was the intent, which was to stop the certification of the election. To intimidate, to coerce, to do whatever they had to do to stop Mike Pence, who they threatened to hang, and to stop the proceedings from happening. And the judge accepted his plea. He faces potentially, as part of what the plea agreement was, from anywhere from 51 to 63 months in jail. Going to be interesting to see where that goes. It was much higher. This was the agreed-to estimated prison time. They claim he's got no record. He is one of the younger defendants. In exchange for his basically ratting out the rest of them, he'll get a lighter sentence. So it will be interesting to see what the other oath keepers, the older ones, what they're going to get. What kind of sentences that we'll see out of them. I'm of the mindset that there should be substantial jail time, if for no other reason than to send the message of you don't do it. So going to be interesting. Now, like I said, Tuesday, I am looking forward to the beginning of this testimony. I find it interesting that Pelosi did what she did, and we'll see, like anything, we'll look back on it and go, was it a smart move? Was it a dumb move? What was it? For right now I'm going, I don't know that I would have. I would have let them sit who they wanted. So they didn't have that talking point. And I know early in the show, Max Burns said, we'll give them a couple of news cycles. I don't know. I'm a little leery of that. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Was it a smart decision? Dumb decision? Would Republicans have done the same thing? You think of the Benghazi hearings, how long those went on forever. It will be interesting to watch. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Lots of things to get to tomorrow. Tune in. I'm going to talk a little bit about the nursing strike that's going on up in Massachusetts. That's on the horizon. Our good friend Sarah Burris back. Lots and lots to get to. Make sure you tune in. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.